All right, so I've got this DVD that was sent to me by Maddie Harland over at Permanent Publications. They're the folks that have Permaculture Magazine, and I've had Maddie in a couple of podcasts in the past, and so she sent me Natural Swimming Pools. And I had it for a while, and then I was going to watch it with Caleb and Krista, who've done some podcasts with me before, and they got real tied up and they couldn't do it. And so I thought, well, who's somebody I know of that's right up this line of work? So I call my friend Mark Vandermeer. He's been in a couple of my videos, and he does a lot of land restoration stuff. Very much permaculture-esque, but without using the word permaculture. And he said, you know, I know somebody who would be even better. And so now I just finished watching it along with Anna Birkus. Have I pronounced your last name right, Anna?
Birkus. That sounds like an SH.
Okay. So, Anna, I got that part right.
You got that part right, yeah.
Yes. Come on. Good. All right. So, And now Mark tells me that this is like one of your great passions in life, so much so that I believe it's even become like your day job.
It has. A couple years ago, I started a company, Village Ecosystem, specializing in sustainable water design and construction. My background.
Yep. The website for that. Like, what's the web? Go ahead and plug your website.
It's villageecosystems.com. And, I have my master's in hydrology, and I'm a general building contractor, so I did watershed work, some of it with Mark, for a long time, and but have always been passionate about sustainable development, so natural swimming pools is one of the products that I'm offering.
All right. Now, when I told you that there's this DVD out, and it's put on by this David Pagan Butler guy,
mm-hmm.
then I believe your response was, who's that?
Because I hadn't heard of him.
And it seems like you know of somebody, because this David Pagan, this is from England. So when this guy does the video, it's all the English accent, which makes it sound like it must be good. He's saying it in an English accent.
Uh-huh.
But then you know of a different guy over in England who has put out a bunch of books on this kind of thing.
Yeah, I know of Michael Littlewood, and he's written a few books, Natural Swimming Pools. I think one is called A Guide to Harmony with Nature, and there's another one that has a similar title to this video, which is A Guide to Designing and Building Your Own. I emailed him a couple years ago when I was first doing my research on this, and I struck up a relationship with Michael Littlewood. So I'm kind of familiar with his work. And then in the last couple years, I've been doing a lot more focus on rainwater and gray water and stormwater and all sorts of other things. And I haven't gone back and looked at what's been published since then. So this is definitely new to me.
Okay. All right. So I took when watching this video, and the video is like an hour and a half long,
mm-hmm.
and it's in two chunks. There's like an hour and 5 minutes for the first chunk, which is about a plunge pool,
mm-hmm.
which is his version 2.0, because version 1.0 was like a full-size swimming pool,
uh-huh.
and he had some bumps in the road with that one.
Yeah.
So he felt that with the new one, he would be way better.
Uh-huh.
And then the second part is like 25 minutes long, and that's covering his experiences with the pool version 1.0.
Right, the first pool he built.
Right, right. So if you're going to watch just one, I guess, you know, because the one that's an hour and 5 minutes long, that one seems to be more like a how-to, and it's better. And then the other, excuse me, the other part is like... like, you know, just so as you know, little notes on things that didn't quite work out.
Right. Kind of thing. I think if you're building it yourself, it's really important to watch both, because the first one makes it look pretty easy because it's his second pool. And when you look at when he tried to build the first pool, which is the second part of the video, there were so many problems, and it's really important to recognize those.
Right, right. Now, I had a list of concerns as watching this, although I do want to give a tip of the hat to the guy for massive innovation. I mean, basically, he's obviously not familiar with that other guy's work, but he's like, he's got some stuff in his head about, like, you know, this ought to work out fine,
mm-hmm.
and then he's put a lot of thought into it, and he's done a ton of innovation to get it, and he does have something that does indeed work. If you look at, you can see the photography of the version 1.0, and it is indeed working. I think both of them can be called a success.
I agree, I also, just as an educational resource, it's nice to compare this to the books done by Michael Littlewood, which are a little bit, well, they're sold as more professional, finer swimming pools, and this is kind of like the funky backyard version. But it's really nice to know that the funky backyard version is an option, because in the other book, I think they would be, $60,000 to $100,000 to build instead of, well, that's, I guess, maybe hiring somebody, but you wouldn't get away with doing them for a few thousand dollars.
Right. And that's part of what we've got here. So we've got something where you'll never need to use chlorine in your pool.
Mm-hmm.
And the water is naturally cleansed and softened by wildlife,
uh-huh.
by nature's creatures who are, well, that's their day job. That's what they do. They clean gobs of water.
Right.
And it does seem like it's on the cheap, although, I have some ideas for getting it to be a lot cheaper still. But we'll get into that a little bit later.
Okay.
I'll just start with the list. I just started writing down. So instead of using pumps, so part of it is like, okay, this guy, it's not like he's building it where there's a creek.
Mm-hmm.
He's building it where there's no running water at all,
mm-hmm.
Unless it rains. And in fact, as he's building it, rain was a bit of a challenge. Rain
mm-hmm.
kind of was screwing stuff up along the way, which I thought it was so great that he made sure to record that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like he was a little surprised when it happened on version 1.0.
Yeah.
And oops.
Yeah.
And then in version 2.0, he was a little better prepared, but he still had some trouble.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that if you've got a creek already, I mean, first of all, the government will probably step in and say, thou shalt not do anything interesting
mm-hmm.
with this water. Although, ponds are a normal thing that can be done. And when you talk to the right government agencies, they'll actually, even pay for it.
Right.
But if you talk to the wrong government agencies, they will kick you in the nuts.
I know. Isn't
so,
that funny how there's so much conflict?
Yeah. Yeah. Some people might think the thing to do is to do the right thing and talk to all the government agencies that demand to be talked to whenever you're going to try and do a project like this.
Mm-hmm.
And that will just bring you great sadness. So,
The rainwater was really interesting. Again, comparing it to the books that I've read about it, some of them said you can't use rainwater because it's not, it's too acidic. And this guy is saying rainwater is the best. And what that says to me is just that there are a lot of options and it's really not so much a can't. I've also heard that you can't use groundwater, and I've seen that done. So I think that the take-home message on that is that use the highest water quality that you can get, and that may be rainwater and it may be groundwater, and you kind of have to look at the various chemical characteristics of your water source to find out what might be best. But the idea of using rainwater is definitely great because you're not taking water from somewhere else.
Well, having combined what you just said, it just kind of makes it funny that somebody had said that it would be too acidic
mm-hmm.
that you would use if you used rainwater, like what was collected on your roof or something. So that means that when those kids jumped into the pool, they might go and be gone.
Well, I think given the context that these were developed in Europe where there is a lot of acid rain, my thought is maybe it has been a big issue over there. And if we all look at kind of like here on the California coast, our water's coming off the Pacific Ocean and it's not really contaminated. So I think it's looking at where your water's coming from and what it might be contaminated with already.
Right. I think that when you're talking about acidity in water,
uh-huh.
and the acid rain, which is eating away a lot of the art of Europe and even some of the buildings of the Northeast
uh-huh.
Of the United States, then I think that the level of acidity of the water is relatively low.
Right.
I mean, we're not talking about something with a pH of 2.
No, we're not.
But we're talking about something probably, I mean, so it's not a lot. And the other thing is that I kind of get the impression that when he says he's using rainwater, it's not while it's raining. And so he must have put it into some kind of tank. And then, of course, once you store it for a while, if you talk about storing water,
mm-hmm.
I mean, Art Ludwig's got that awesome book about water storage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like there are ways to store water, so the quality of the water goes up the longer it is stored.
Hmm.
And so he could be pouring some of that into his pond.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like,
right.
You know, yeah, I think you're spot on in saying, you know, use whatever is the highest quality water that you can get. Although I think another thing to go with here is the whole idea of if you plant this right and you do it right, it's going to clean whatever water you put into it. And there's ways to do that as well. I mean, it's not like you're going to go out and get some water that's like right out of some kind of toxic gick factory and mm-hmm. then pour that in.
Well, I think that there is a sensitive balance with the wetland ecosystems, and that that they can deal with the nutrients that's brought into the pool by human bodies and by the salamanders and stuff. But if you have a water source that's heavy in nutrients that you're bringing in, that might overburden them and they might not be able to keep it clean. Like creek water, for example, might not work out, especially if it's an agricultural region or something.
So I would think, well, true. I mean, if you've got creek water and it's got a CAFO in the creek uphill, okay, I could see that being a problem.
Uh-huh.
But I would think that if you've got creek water and you've got a cow pasture a mile upstream, I think you're going to be just fine if it's not like something where they've got a CAFO right in the creek.
Yeah, I think it's just kind of knowing your water sources and knowing what's around and being familiar with it enough to make that call. I mean, nitrogen contamination in the United States is a really big issue, especially in ag regions and with septic tanks. And, you know, it could even be that your well water is not good enough because it's high in nitrates or something. But,
true.
And then I believe that it's not usually good to have fish in the ponds. One reason being that they can eat the zooplankton and other critters, but also because they produce too much nutrients. I've heard. I don't know if that's, you know, real or not, but I do think it's a sensitive balance, and that if you get some nutrient loading from multiple sources and it kind of adds up, then you could have an algal growth problem. And it also depends on, you know, how warm your climate is, and, you know, it might not be of a concern as much in a more of a northern climate, and there could be some, you know, hotter climates where it would be a bigger issue.
True, and you know, I'm realizing that this podcast could be a 10-hour podcast because suddenly I'm kind of thinking to myself, okay, because I was kind of thinking like I would like to see fish added to this, and then of course, as the fish take in other materials that are in the pond, such as tiny critters,
mm-hmm.
then they're going to convert 10% of the tiny critter into new fish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in themselves, they'll then become a slightly larger fish, and then the rest of it will be fish poop, which used to be that critter,
mm-hmm.
which was going to turn into sludge one way or another anyway.
Mm-hmm. Except fish poop contaminates, whereas that critter before was cleaning the water.
Okay, so like, and it depends on the critter, and
uh-huh.
I think there's something to be said for like, you're going to have your shallower water and you're going to have your deeper water. So for example, like let's say you have trout. Trout are only going to be able to tolerate moderately cold water,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to avoid the warmer water, which is where a lot of your filtration's going, where a lot mm-hmm. of your critters are living.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so now you're the expert. I'm not, so I'll say these things, then you can tell me that I'm full of shit or not. And so,
a fish expert, honestly. So I haven't experimented with adding fish to an ecosystem, and I'm really interested in it, and I would like to see also if it's possible to add fish to the system. But what I've heard is that people have done it and it hasn't really worked. And I have questions about, you know, should the fish be separated in a different pond? And then if they are separated, is there a point in mixing that water? And, you know, maybe there is an ecosystem that can be developed. I mean, I've definitely seen beautiful fish ponds that are deep and have clear water that aren't natural swimming pools. So it seems possible.
Well, I think a big key is that I've been to a lot of ponds where they've put in a bunch of bubblers,
mm-hmm.
and then they just put in like a skillion fish, and it's like the whole thing is just packed with fish. And so I would say that's too many fish.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to then have problems. But then by keeping it full of all kinds of bubblers, you're getting enough oxygen for all those fish, and at the time, the water's oxygenated enough that they're not having much in the way of an algae problem.
Right.
But I would like to think that one of the things that you could have is a few trout in a pond like this. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it seems like one of the missions they're trying to do is they're trying to keep the water fairly warm, so that way, it's more comfortable for swimming. And that means, okay, now you're probably not going to have trout in there.
Yeah. And another thing that I'm noticing is there's really a big scale. It's kind of like between natural swimming pools and regular swimming pools and ponds. And it's Michael Littlewood's books were about natural swimming pools that were pretty fancy, had, you know, quite clear water and such. And this guy is, again, much more on the scale of being closer to a pond or maybe somewhere in the middle. And then you were also talking about doing natural swimming pools with outliners. And it's kind of like a gradient. And somebody could find their way on that gradient. They don't have to be like, I'm building a natural swimming pool and it has to look like this and it can't have fish.
Oh, that's a very good point. Some people might say, I'm building a pond for trout, and I might also have a little side edge of it that's going to be kind of swimming pool-esque.
Yeah, and still have the wetland and everything, and it might be a different design, but it could incorporate aspects in natural swimming pools, and it might have a little more algae in it, or it might not, and who cares? I mean, I like swimming in ponds, but I think the point of this natural swimming pool concept is for people that really, a lot of people are pretty scared of ponds, actually. About the gunkiness and the goopiness and the mud and all of that. And the natural swimming pool, like, takes the pond and makes it all look kind of pretty and clean. But it's pretty and clean like a regular swimming pool, but it's still environmentally friendly and healthy and doesn't have the chemicals and everything.
Right. And so I do think that that's something that I want to get into more is the part where it's kind of like, okay, because you're right, ponds typically have goop at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And I, at the same time, I think it's possible to have a pond that does not have goop at the bottom.
It is, yeah.
It can be challenging. I mean, goop at the bottom is part of what a pond is all about.
Yeah.
I mean, there's all kinds of lovely life happening within that goop. And I also think that for most ponds that are built on farms are going to be something where there is a creek of some kind involved.
Mm-hmm.
And typically the creek is a year-round creek.
Mm-hmm.
But so in this case, I mean, I think we're saying, okay, this is basically, it looks like they've got something of an urban or urbanish lot, maybe suburban, and they've got a little bit of space, but not a lot of space. And so they can put in a pool, but in order for the pool to get deep enough, they do have to have the edges rather straight up and down, which was an interesting thing.
Yeah. The depth was interesting. I noticed he said it's 2 meters deep. And in Michael Littlewood's books, he says you have to have 3 meters. Again, because the depth keeps the water cooler, and he's trying to keep the water cool, so there's less algal growth, and that just might be another factor of how much algal growth do you accept, and is it okay if your water is slightly murky or not, you know?
This water seemed pretty clear to me.
It was pretty clear. I thought so, too. But he's also in England, where it's pretty overcast
cool.
And cool, so he might not have as much issues.
So I think the earlier I was trying to talk about the bubblers that he's using in here, and I think that the key is that, you know, if you're going to not have a creek passing through your pool/pond, you're going to need to circulate the water somehow. You'll have to use some sort of mechanical means to circulate the water.
Uh-huh.
I do not know of something that's like a totally passive way of circulating water in a pond at this time. And so my mind thinks you got to have something mechanical. And in this case, I thought it was pretty interesting that instead of using a water pump, he used a bubbler. And I know that that bubblers can work. I just kind of thought, wow, you're going to have to that's going to be a lot of air in that bubbler. But basically the idea is that you'll have a vertical pipe. You'll put the bubbler at the bottom. It creates so many bubbles that it's probably at least one-third bubbles, one-third air moving up, and it carries the water up with it. So in a way, it makes for like kind of a weak pump.
It pulls
and it
the
does,
water. So yeah, it's
it
like
does.
Suction.
it does work. It is really kind of fascinating that it does work. And normally I'm used to seeing it in like fish tanks, aquariums.
Right.
But it is something when done on a larger scale like this. It does, and he had an example in this video, and you can see it actually the water bubbling out of the top higher than the other water level,
mm-hmm.
with nothing but a bubbler. And I thought, oh, awesome demonstration.
Yeah.
And then he had clear video where you could kind of see little flecks of flotsam getting in it. And then he made a quote at some point that I thought was just really excellent, and where he said something about a frog could go through this unscathed.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, oh, that is just sweet.
Yeah.
You know, and I hadn't thought about that because mm-hmm. I was kind of thinking, wouldn't a regular standard water pump be more efficient mm-hmm. than the bubbler system? But when he said the thing about the frog, I thought, that is awesome. I hadn't thought of that.
Mm-hmm.
His using the bubbler is brilliant.
Yeah.
And now I can't imagine using anything but a bubbler now.
I'm not 100% convinced yet, although I really enjoy the innovation of it. And I like that it's low electricity use. I think that in terms of regular pumps, there's lots of solutions for frogs and stuff. So you don't have to worry about that. But I like that it's low energy use. I like that you could kind of create it yourself and do it with really inexpensive parts. And I'm still not convinced that it's as effective at circulating the water, at least how he did it. It looks like he kind of haphazardly threw, I guess I'll describe it a little bit first. Basically, the wetland area is on top of, the plants are planted on top of some gravel, and that gravel has pipes in it that are perforated. And there needs to be air circulation down there in that region where the plant roots are growing, because that's where the water is getting purified. So this bubbler sucks water from these perforated pipes that are in that area and pulls it into the main body of the swimming pool. And the way he was laying the pipes, I had the question of, is there enough pipe to go around that's really aerating those roots? But he didn't really show very much pipe. He could have put more in it. It wasn't really clear. And then he said that with his one solar panel, he was able to run it for an hour a day. And I wonder if that's enough. I
thought the same thing too.
Yeah, I wonder if it's enough. And I've been told that the whole body of water within the pool should be exchanged. I guess that was through the filter. Well, I got the idea that the whole body of water should be circulated within 2 to 3 days. So I was wondering, is it all getting circulated efficiently? And then the other question I had is that circulation is supposed to be a really slow circulation because pond critters are not used to fast-moving water, and that's what's habitating that environment. So I was wondering if the bubbles disrupted them. Like, I've heard that zooplankton's disrupted by a slightly quick current. And so I just was wondering about that sort of efficiency.
Well, first off, I think that the speed of the current is not going to be very fast because the bubblers are going to. I mean, if you had a regular water pump,
mm-hmm.
you could get a current that is like the. I mean, you could move a lot of water with a 12-volt water pump.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what he's doing here, and I don't think it moves that much water. I think it's just a little bit of water. Now, clearly, by looking at these images, we're looking at a pond that's pretty decent. And I mean, so
right.
the bottom line is that, because that was when I heard him say he's going to run it for an hour a day, because my first thought was, it's like, no, you got to keep that water moving 24/7. And it's like, and then he's like, oh, I run it for an hour a day. And it's my thinking was, is like, oh, this is going to suck. but then we see the images of it in there, and it's like, well, I'm not seeing algae even getting started.
Yeah.
And the water looks pretty clear.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wrong, and he's right. I mean, he's right. He's right. It's working.
Well, there's a little algae. It's not 100% clear. And if it was me, I would probably throw on another solar panel. But I think you're right. I think the speed is probably slow enough of the water. It was more the place of the actual bubbles I was concerned about disrupting the water. But honestly, since they're located in just specific locations, I'm sure that the various critters can swim to more peaceful water and be fine.
Right.
It's not like
okay.
the whole body shot is all moving so quickly. It's just these little areas that are moving quickly. Or, you know, the rapid bubbling motion is quick. But I think it's probably fine.
Right. I think that it's, I think there's the rate that the water is moving is relatively slow.
Right.
Much slower than if it was an actual water pump.
Mm-hmm.
I am worried. I mean, clearly we're looking at this. Maybe you saw some algae. I didn't see. I was looking for algae. I didn't see any. And maybe the pond's not old enough. Maybe it's going to get it more later. Maybe it's right on the edge of keeping the algae at bay. Maybe they went and scooped a bunch of it out in order to make the video.
I didn't see much, and most shots were clear. It just seemed that there was like one or two shots underwater where it had a slight greenish murkiness to it, where there wasn't like actual like filamentous algae that you could see, but it just had a slight green hue, so I felt like there was probably some like algae floating in there that was too small to see, if you know
okay.
what I mean.
Right.
So a very small amount of algae.
At the very beginning of the first video.
I think it was near the beginning of the first video.
Yeah, I was kind of, okay, now that you say that, I remember that, and I was kind of wondering about that. And I did think that there was a little bit too much particulate in the water in general at the very beginning. I was kind of thinking, that doesn't look like as clean as I would like it to be.
Yeah, it's clean enough for me, but if I'm going to offer a professional service to somebody, I need to know that I have more options than just that, and that's a very good, inexpensive option that I would consider installing, and I would install, but I would also have more tools to work with.
So I would be worried. Now, I know that like you can, if you go to Layman's Catalog or whatever, there's all kinds of places for people that are doing farm ponds that it's a common thing that you can get where you can have like a windmill with a bubbler, or there's a thing that you can plop right in and it just puts bubbles into the water,
right.
And it's just got a little solar panel on it, and that's all it is. Whenever the sun's out, it puts bubbles in the water.
Uh-huh.
And my thinking for all of that is that it's not going to cut it. And that, I mean, of course, the first thing is nothing's as good as having a creek of some kind dribbling water in.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best. And and then once you start, you know, having something that doesn't have a creek, then you got to get in all these artificial means, which I'd rather not do. But, of course, if you're in an urban situation and you want to have a pool, this is superior. So, yeah, artificial means are going to come in one way or another. I've always not liked the idea of solar or wind powered bubblers,
mm-hmm.
because of the idea that they're not. I want 24/7, and apparently I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm.
For one thing is that the some people say, okay, well, you got all the plants that are in the water and they're providing oxygen,
mm-hmm.
and it's like, ah, actually they're providing oxygen during the day,
mm-hmm.
but at night they consume oxygen,
mm-hmm.
and so, you know, and if you've got a solar thing, then you've got at night you've got only so much dissolved oxygen in the water,
mm-hmm.
and then the plants are consuming it, and then your bubbler isn't bubbling,
mm-hmm.
so it's kind of like, and then any life that's currently in the water, they're consuming it too, and it's kind of like, what's going to happen if you run out,
mm-hmm.
and that worries me. It makes me nervous. Is there enough for everybody to get by through the night?
Right.
And so I feel like as a steward of the pond, I feel like I would be a poor steward to go with solar. But obviously this guy has pulled it off, and there is life in the pond, and you are a greater expert than I, so maybe I should just shut up for a minute.
I think that you can go with solar. I don't think you need to have it bubbling all the time. I actually am not even convinced that a bubbler is the right way to go. Again, reading Michael Littlewood's books, he says that you don't want a bubbler, or, you know, you have to take into consideration if you have like a small waterfall that it could disturb that wetland community of various creatures. And that it's not like a regular pond, and that you don't want a creek running through it, because you're trying to get the kind of critters that live there that like these environments that are, you know, they're wetlands. They don't have a lot of flowing water through them. So it's something that I don't feel like I've made up my mind on whether or not bubblers are good or not, but I don't think it's like a regular pond where we're just going, yes, we want aeration, because we do have this sensitive balanced ecosystem, and most of the plants that we're putting in that ecosystem aren't evolved for fast running water.
So I think that in a pond, in any pond, is like on one end, okay, let's say it does have a creek. And so you're saying Littlewood says don't do that, and I'm saying okay, but setting that aside for a moment, I'm thinking you got a creek, you got water coming in, and if it's dribbling in or bubbling in or doing a waterfall trick or whatever, the higher up it is before it hits the water, the more air we're going to get into the water. But the thing is that you got your pond, and if your pond is something that's got some size to it, like let's say it's at least 30 feet across, and in which case you've got all your bubbly action going on one end of the pond, and the rest of the pond you don't have the bubbly action, which from a permaculture perspective I think is really good, because now you've got diversity. You've got some bits of water that have lots and lots and lots of air, and you got some bits of water where it's, not so much. And then, you know, the spectrum in between in all kinds of different places. You have more edge, more diversity.
I think that it's about limiting it. If you're going to use bubblers or a waterfall, I think it should be tried to, you know, maintain it on one side of the pond. Don't put it directly into the wetland, that kind of thing.
Right, because some stuff doesn't like having a lot of oxygen in the water, and some stuff is hog wild excited about lots of oxygen in the water.
Well, I think the oxygen in the water part is fine. I think it's just about the speed of the current is hard on some plants and on some critters that have it.
Right.
So that I think that's it. And I mean, generally, I think as much oxygen you can get in a pond is great, you know, and that's, I guess, another component to mention associated with that is temperature, just that colder water holds more oxygen. So if you're in a warmer climate, you're going to have more concern with this, and you're going to maybe want to make a deeper pool as well so you can keep the temperature low. And if you're in more of a northern or cooler climate, it might not be as much of an issue.
Well, see, now another thing that I'm from my limited knowledge about pondage is that typically the deeper water has less oxygen, and it has more to do with, like, you know, with the still water, which most ponds, you know, are probably going to be 95% still water, because you're going to have some motion at one end, and then you're going to have motion at the other end where the water's piddling out. But and so most of it's still, and then it tends to stratify with the oxygen ending up higher up.
Right.
So if you have colder water down low, like what, you know, Littlewood's talking about, then it kind of seems like you're not going to really have, I mean, it might be able, the colder water might be able to hold more oxygen, but there isn't going to be much oxygen down there just because, you know, it's stratified. The layers, that's a layer that tends to not have a lot.
And that's where that circulation, I think, comes in, is why that's so important. Is to get that cold. You're keeping the whole pool kind of cold. Because I think if you have like a surface pond, like that's only 5 feet deep or something, it really heats up quickly. The whole thing gets hot. But having that cold reservoir of water can kind of keep the whole thing cool. And it seems like you're really going for the kind of that perfect temperature where you can get it as hot as you can so that you can swim in it without having it, you know, create an algal bloom. And so I think that having that cold reservoir of water down there allows you to kind of regulate the temperature a little.
Okay. So because now that was another thing that was kind of like as they were getting started, and I didn't understand all of his goals. It's like, look, we're going to insulate the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of thinking, what? Why would you do that?
I questioned that at first too.
And then later he's like, well, it's because we want it to get warm and stay warm.
Yeah. And if I was in England and I wanted to swim, I would as well.
Okay. Yeah, all right. Well, now, they're just a little bit further north, because now you used to live in Missoula.
I did.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so now I think England is just a little ways further north than Missoula. But they're also close to that ocean thing.
Right.
They call it Atlantic, I think. And that tends to be a body of water that tends to keep things in England a little warmer, that whole coastal warmitude thing. So I'm thinking that, you know, maybe the weather between here and there could be comparable. But I also know that I've been to lakes that are of this same altitude in eastern Washington. Mm-hmm. So we're still talking about an area where it gets to be 20 below.
Mm-hmm.
And on the end of June, going swimming in them, and they were plenty warm.
Mm-hmm.
And they were deep, but there's things going on and whatnot. So I don't know. I'm kind of thinking like you could still have warm pools without having to have the insulation. Now, granted, the idea is that the soil beneath it is going to have this standard ground temperature, mm-hmm, of like 54 degrees,
mm-hmm,
and which is a little too cold for swimming. In fact, that's part of it. Is if you try to go swimming in cold water, it's hard to breathe.
Right.
And it's not much fun. Even if it's a really hot day, mm-hmm, swimming in really cold water is really kind of annoying.
Mm-hmm.
And so you really want the water temperature to probably be warmer than 60.
Uh-huh.
Maybe even warmer than 70.
Yeah, and I think, I can't remember the exact temperatures that were suggested, but I think that 70 is about where you can get this pool to, or in the low 70s, where you generally don't have problems with algae and stuff. So, something to consider.
I just kind of think that if we've got, I mean, basically the other thing is this water is being recirculated.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like there's a creek coming in or a creek going out.
I think that's a really good point right there, because you were talking about ponds with creeks and how that's ideal for ponds in many situations. And I think that it's important to understand that you may have the same body of water more or less for years. You're not switching it out. And so it really is actually cleaning itself. Whereas you have a creek going into a pond, if it's like a natural pond or something, that's the water in that pond is really changing over time.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Depending on the time of year. I mean, when there's a heavy, when you're talking about springtime or wintertime and there's a big floody kind of thing going on,
mm-hmm,
you're going to get a lot of sediment introduced into your pond.
Right.
In this pool where there's not a creek coming in, then you're just recirculating the exact same water.
Right.
Over
you get
and
a little
and
evaporated and you add a little to top it off, and you could be 20 years later with the same. A lot of the same water.
And with this much shallow water, it seems like you're going to be warming that water up an awful lot.
Yeah, and I think that this is, again, one of those climate-sensitive things, because I've heard people using solar panels to heat their natural swimming pools because they need to keep them warmer, and then this guy's using insulation because he wants it, you know, a little warmer than ground temperature. And I think, you know, if you were in the desert in Arizona or something, you might want to consider not having that insulation because you'd want that cooling effect of that ground. So it's going to be climate and sensitive, or regionally sensitive.
But wouldn't the down deep temperature below your pond of, you know, the soil that's 20 feet deep not be 54 in the desert? But if you're in an area that's really warm, it might be 75.
I don't think it is. I believe that it's a little bit warmer, but I believe that soil temperature is one of those things that doesn't vary greatly. So I'd like to hear somebody tell me exactly what it is in the desert, but that's my understanding, is that if you get pretty deep, it's still pretty cool.
See, now my understanding is that the soil temperature that's like 20 feet deep is effectively, in a way, an average of the surface temperature throughout the year.
Uh-huh.
That's my understanding. And so in an area where it's like, you know, a lot warmer, then the down deep temperature is going to be a lot warmer than, say, here in Missoula.
Uh-huh. Right, because you have hot summers.
I mean, you think about it. I mean, if you go up to Alaska, you get your permafrost.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so then that's down deep, and that's like ice.
Right, so down there in Alaska, if you could manage to build one of these, maybe inside of a greenhouse, you'd want some good insulation, you know. But in Arizona, you're still going to have cooler soil temperatures than you're having air temperatures in the summer when you're swimming. So you could. So I would assume you wouldn't want to insulate. But maybe you would for some reason. Maybe just for to try to regulate the temperature and keep it about the same. Or, well, the soil would do that too. I'm not sure. It seems like it would vary to me.
All right, moving through my list, I've got a thing on here where I'm pretty sure I saw a newt.
Yes, I saw a newt.
And I was thinking, cool, a newt.
Yep, I thought it was something. And a snail and a frog, I think.
So there was, a crustacean. There's all kinds of fun little wildlife. And then it had the kid getting a bucket full of water and like, look at all of my friends.
Uh-huh.
And he's like being interactive and probably simultaneously killing them.
Mm-hmm.
But, in the name of education, you know. So I thought it was really cool to see a lot of the different kinds of animals that they videoed there. They said fraction of the cost. I don't know. I'm not sure what the cost of a swimming pool would be for the size that they had there, but probably $25,000 or $30,000.
I think so. But they're building it all themselves, so I'm not really sure it's a fraction of the cost. I would guess that it would be less expensive than a regular swimming pool because you're not doing all that cement work. The way he did it. The way he did it, I think it would be less expensive. Maybe half or something if you hired somebody. But even then, I'm not sure. I think that if you've done yourself, that it's a fraction.
I think it'd be good to know. I'd like to find out. I'd like to find out how much he spent on the big pool, which was version 1.0.
He said 5,000 pounds.
Now that was. Oh, was it 5,000? Because I wrote down, I think, 2,000. Yeah, I wrote down 2,000 pounds for the plunge.
Yep.
Okay.
Because I wrote
those
down.
The big one was 5,000. So that's about probably $8,000.
Uh-huh.
So.
And it was a few years ago, so it's probably 10.
So, if you lived in Missoula and you said, I want a swimming pool,
uh-huh.
Then there'd probably be some guy that would come in with a track hoe, dig a big hole, and then they would probably shotcrete it or something like that, and then they would put on layers of waterproofy goo and then the different kinds of bits and bobs of equipment and then other cement to kind of level it out. I don't know. I would guess $20,000-$25,000.
I think that's about the cheapest you can get a swimming pool for.
Okay.
And I think that so, it kind of goes up from there.
So what he did was cheap, although I was still kind of thinking, man, that seems like a lot of dough for what he got there. But it's cheap and you're not using the chlorine. It's pretty much a self-maintaining swimming pool.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So I got fractional. I saw. He used, on version 1.0, he had a bunch of tires, like car tires.
I noticed that, too.
And I kind of had big negative thoughts once I saw that. Like, I'm so against that. And he didn't really talk about it very much, but he seemed to be okay with it.
You mean just the fact that they were in your swimming water?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and he said a lot of things where he's very concerned about the environmental impact, and
mm-hmm.
he's done a lot of research to try and reduce environmental impact, and he's very concerned about the environment, which I thought, yay!
Mm-hmm.
And then we got to the part where I saw those tires, and I just kind of thought, no!
It's funny, because I had the opposite reaction. I saw those tires, and I went, yay!
Okay, so you're thinking it's great to get them out of the waste stream.
Right. And I'm thinking less cement. I would be interested to see them stacked underneath the liner instead. I'm not sure if you have to worry about contaminants and swimming with tires or not. But, I was thinking about getting them out of the waste stream.
So my first thought was, why didn't he at least cover them with something so that way when the sun hits them, then they're not, like, off-gassing? Because,
mm-hmm.
of course, you know, any kind of, petroleum-ish, like, thing like that,
mm-hmm.
or even rubber or whatever, anything that's – because we know that the tires themselves, you know, it's not exactly an edible thing.
Right.
And it's not exactly an organic thing, you know. And it's like when little bits of tire off-gasses or decomposes off, I mean, it's a little bit of toxic gick that,
mm-hmm.
that comes off and goes into your swimming pool there. And that one of the things is that I've when you use polyethylene,
mm-hmm.
and if it doesn't get sunlight on it, it's supposed to last like 500 years. But
mm-hmm.
if you get sunlight on it, it only lasts like 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's you know so UV radiation degrades it rapidly,
mm-hmm.
and so I'm kind of thinking like so when I saw that I'm thinking okay, I don't like the idea of the tires putting toxic gick into the water,
mm-hmm.
And especially where sun can hit it.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe I mean, it's not like there's been some sort of white paper published in a peer-reviewed journal about tires off-gassing when used in natural swimming pools.
Right.
So it's like, you know, it's kind of an unknown. But my heebie-jeebie factor is up with that, and I would personally want to not have that in my pool. But maybe I'm just being a nervous
right.
Nelly inappropriately.
I'm not sure on that one either. I don't know.
But your nervous Nelly factor is obviously much lower than mine on this one.
I wasn't that concerned about it, although before I put it in mine now, I might look into it. I just see the excitement of a free resource that's a recycle and you get to use it. So that's what I was thinking when I saw those.
So I've given you the heebie-jeebies by bringing it up.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
I wanted to go back to the cost. I had another thought on that, which is that natural swimming pools have to be 50% or more wetland area, which is not really a swimming area, although you could walk around and plan it and stuff and a great place for kids. So when you're thinking about the cost of it, if you want a swimming area of a certain size, then your natural swimming pool would be twice the size of your regular swimming pool. Now, if you just want water surface area of a certain size, it could be the same, and one portion would be for swimming. But it's a consideration.
And I think he did an admirable job of that. In fact, I think he might have even had more than half of the area was set up to be the shallower stuff.
It was more than half the area on both, I believe. So that was that might be why his water is clear, even though he's cutting other corners.
That probably explains it. All right, so. I'm going through my list. A lot of this we already talked about that one already.
I guess that's
vertical.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, go. No, you go ahead.
Okay, there's a couple things I really loved, and I love the innovation. I love that he showed his mistakes, and I like to be innovative and figure things out and use simple things. And one thing that struck me was the waterproof duct tape for his overflow drain and for other things. And I was like, really, he's just going to glue these waterproof duct tape so that his water from his pond doesn't all flow out. And then the other thing that I really liked was that torch he used when he wants to join the overlayment, which is kind of like a geotextile plastic fabric to protect the liner, that he just kind of melts it with a torch and sticks it together. And I like little tricks like that, and I want to see how that – I want to know more about waterproof duct tape.
Well, okay. While we're talking about those things, I too agree that the thing with the torch and getting that poly mesh stuff to kind of stick to itself, that poly felt – mm-hmm. To kind of stick to it. So that was a neat trick. That was cute.
Yeah, and although, that innovation and that just general happy-go-lucky attitude makes the whole thing feel achievable and approachable. Like, you know, if you kind of know your way around construction, you could take this on, you know, and that's really a nice feeling watching something like this.
When it comes to the waterproof duct tape, mm-hmm. I had two different reservations about that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, granted, it worked and everything, yay. But my thinking was that he had a piece of pipe that was probably like this 3-inch black plastic pipe mm-hmm. that he's trying to push through EPDM.
Mm-hmm.
And then he kind of cut a star pattern into the EPDM
mm-hmm.
and then pushed the pipe through, and then he put the duct tape on that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at it thinking, that has got to be the worst way to do that.
I wouldn't do it either, but I just appreciated seeing it in the video for some reason.
I just thought, you know, on that star pattern approach that he went with,
mm-hmm.
one of the little stars is going to, like, rip far up the EPDM, and mm-hmm. he's going to have a big leak there.
Yeah.
That's what went through my mind. Mm-hmm. And of course, time will tell whether he's brilliant and I'm just a whiner.
Well, that's I'm curious about it, because it didn't seem like it would be good enough to me, but...
So he has this pipe that's about 3 inches that he's putting through. I think what I would have tried
mm-hmm.
is to make a cut in the EPDM that's 1 inch in diameter, and then to stretch that around the pipe.
Uh-huh.
And then that stretching of the EPDM around the pipe would have in itself created the seal that he's looking for.
Yeah. Well, they also just have those, like, screwable clamps that fit on the pipes, and then you screw them down, and they're not very expensive, and then they're, like, designed for that. And so I would probably go for that method because I feel safe.
Okay. So there's that part. The next thing I would do is that I'm just not a fan of putting a hole in EPDM whenever it's used.
Uh-huh.
I would have rather have had something that goes over something than through something.
Yeah.
Okay.
When I first saw the video, I thought the drain was supposed to, like, drain the whole pool, and I was like, now how is he going to do that? Why is it up so high? Because he didn't make it clear that it was an overflow. So I might consider having a drain in a pool. I could see reasons to do it, but he, you know, that wasn't the point. It was just to have a safe overflow.
You know, I think rather than having a drain, mm-hmm. I like the idea of simply having some pipe, like poly pipe, around somewhere, and then you just use the mighty power of the siphon.
Yeah, siphons are great. Yep.
Yeah, I think I would have probably gone with that. So he did not put a drain in this,
mm-mm.
which I think that's probably how I would fly too.
I think I probably would, but there could be a reason for a drain.
So if you put a drain in, that would mean that you would have to poke a hole in that EPDM somewhere.
Yeah, it would.
So, all right. Vertical walls is my next note.
Okay.
And I'm kind of thinking, all right, well, yeah, if you're in a small area and you want to have certain kind of depth,
mm-hmm.
then it does seem like, okay, yeah, you've got to somehow figure out the vertical walls thing. You got to do something either really, really steep or, yes, have vertical walls. And when we think of a swimming pool, we do often think of something that has, you know, some vertical wall stuff in mm-hmm. there. And I just kind of kept thinking to myself, I guess I'm too used to ponds, and ponds being just perfectly lovely for swimming in,
mm-hmm.
well, with the exception of the muckiness that can sometimes occur
mm-hmm.
at the bottom, but how a pond can be a lovely thing to swim in, and there's not vertical walls. And it seems like the vertical walls aspect, I think, is a big part of what added a lot of expense to this project.
It does.
And I kind of think about, like, you know, wow, is there a way to have come up with something that may have been less expensive, less time-consuming to come up with vertical walls?
Mm-hmm.
And my mind went through a bunch of different things. One of the things, well, and maybe even the things that I'm thinking of would have been not as good simply because they may have been more expensive for the region that he's in.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things I was thinking of is that there's this weird relationship with cedar and how bodies of water in nature somehow, like, totally groove on a cedar tree dropping into a creek. It's
mm-hmm.
like somehow all the fish and wildlife come out and say, yes, yes, cedar, I so love cedar in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And which is kind of weird because because cedar and other plant life don't get along.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would think that, you know, but for somehow cedar in water does magical, awesome things.
Huh.
So I, at the same time, cedar is one that rots very slowly, and I think that when it's in water, I think it actually might last longer than if it's,
uh-huh.
you know, out in soil and air.
Right. I agree. It may.
So I start to think to myself, you know, I wonder if you could, like, you know, if you had cedar trees growing on your land already, or if you had a source for cedar, maybe there's something that could be done with making your vertical walls out of something cedar.
Yeah.
And even roundwood cedar, even, like, stuff that's too small to mill up into other things.
Right. Well, I've seen log walls built for natural pools, but they always had a liner on top of them, so they weren't in the water. And I would definitely research plant compatibility with cedar before putting it in, or redwood, or any of those woods that have strong compounds in them that stop bugs from eating them, basically.
Right.
And so I'm still imagining that it would be under the liner, unless we go to the realm of no liners. And then the idea of vertical walls, I think it's a space thing, and it could also be a temperature thing.
Okay, Anna, I got to I got to stop you because somehow, you know, we are recording our podcast using the mighty Skype, and somehow Skype decided it would be funny if you sounded like a robot.
Oh, okay. Do I still sound like a robot?
Yeah, but it's even funnier when you say it sounds like a robot and you sound like a robot.
Well, shall we wrap up our thing, or what would you like to do?
Oh, you know what? Let's do this. Let's proclaim this to be Natural Swimming Pools Review Part 1.
Okay.
And wrap this one up, and then we'll wait for Skype to heal, and then we'll try it again.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, so that's part one, folks.
Thank you, Paul. I'll talk to you soon.
If you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about natural swimming pools, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.